Let's be honest, everyone hates bank fees. The last thing I want to do is to pay to access my own money. But there's good news. Chime is changing the way people bank. They're not like traditional banks that love to gatekeep the best rewards and pile on hidden fees unless you have a massive balance. Chime offers the most rewarding fee-free banking. We're talking no overdraft fees, no monthly fees, and no minimum balance fees. And with Chime Card, you're empowered to build your credit through everyday spending, getting 5% cash back in categories of your choice. Not to mention Chime's savings rate is 9 times the national average. Join the millions who are already banking fee-free. Head to chime.com/redhanded. That's chime.com/redhanded. Sign up now. It only takes a few minutes. Chime is a fintech, not a bank. Banking services and Chime Card provided by Chime's bank partners. Qualifying direct deposits required. Terms and limits apply. Go to chime.com/disclosures for details.
This is Matt Rogers from Las Culturistas with Matt Rogers and Bowen Yang.
This is Bowen Yang from Las Culturistas with Matt Rogers and Bowen Yang.
You know when people try a new food and suddenly it's like, wait.
That's the reaction a lot of people are having when they first try Kewpie Mayo.
It's the one with the red cap and the little baby on the bottle. You've probably seen it in the grocery store before.
And if you've ever just walked past it, some people would say that's a huge mistake.
Because this mayo is different.
Most mayonnaise uses whole eggs. Kewpie only uses egg yolks, which gives it this rich umami flavor. It's smoother, deeper, and almost buttery.
Once people try it, they start putting it on everything.
Egg sandwiches, fries, burgers. Some fans even swear by dipping pizza crust in it.
And once you notice it, you start seeing it everywhere.
Chefs use it. Restaurants use it. People who really care about flavor use it.
Never tried it? Grab the bottle with the red cap next time you're at the store.
Put it on just about anything.
Then you'll understand.
Kewpie, the original Japanese mayonnaise.
Hello, Trafalgar Square.
My name is Linda Carney.
I'm speaking to you from Death Row in Texas, in the United States. It is everybody's worst nightmare to be executed for a crime they did not commit. I am living that nightmare.
I'm Hannah.
I'm Saruti.
And this is Red Handed. Today we're taking you through how a drug-related break-in gone wrong in Texas landed a British DEA informant on death row. And I, in particular, am excited for this one because I finally get to totally fangirl over lawyer extraordinaire Clive Stafford Smith. Like, I have very complex emotional feelings for Clive Stafford Smith. I love him. He's the founder and director of a non-profit called Reprieve that campaigns against human rights violations and represents individuals who are victims of extreme human rights abuses all over the world. So Clive Stafford Smith has got 63 people out of Guantanamo Bay. He's represented over 300 people facing the death penalty, and he's won almost every case. And I think, I don't know if this is true, but I think I heard that he has appeared in the highest court in America more than any American lawyer. He also appears in the documentary called 14 Days in May, which if you haven't seen, I think it might have been the first true crime documentary I ever watched, and it's so, so good. And if that documentary doesn't turn you off the death penalty, absolutely nothing will. So our story doesn't actually start in Texas. It starts on the fourth plinth of Trafalgar Square in London. And for those of you who don't know, the statue on top of the fourth plinth changes reasonably often. So the plinth itself is just sort of like a concrete tower. Not concrete, stone tower. And then whatever statue is on top of it changes at regular intervals. The other statues on the other plinths are always the same, and they have been for hundreds of years. And at the moment, the fourth plinth is sporting this like massive bronze hand giving the thumbs up, but the thumb is like the length of a finger.
What's that about?
Which, have you seen it?
No, I haven't.
It's just a sculpture.
Oh.
I quite liked it when there was a massive ship in a bottle. I quite liked that one.
I feel
one.
Like I never go anywhere near Trafalgar Square for like work or life. And I think the last time I actually saw the fourth plinth was when they had that big blue cock on it. Like a bird cock.
That was a good one.
Not male genitalia cock.
Was it in Paris they had that Christmas tree sculpture that looked like a butt plug and they had to take it
oh,
down?
Oh yeah. Was that meant to? Or was it just a happy accident?
I think it was a happy accident. Do you want to hear my best Trafalgar Square fact?
Please.
So you know Nelson's Column?
Mm-hmm.
At the bottom of Nelson's Column, there are big, what?
Lions?
Yes. And the lions are made of iron. And where do you think they got that iron from?
The Roald Dahl Museum. I don't know. That's where you're a font of knowledge from, isn't it? I don't know.
I am a font of knowledge about so much more than Roald Dahl. How dare you?
I was just trying to cover my ignorance. I don't know. Where did the iron and the lions come from?
The cannons of French warships.
Of course they did.
Yeah, that's... We are bad winners as a nation.
Yeah, we are. Look at Brexit. That is... that we are bad. We are a nation of bad winners, and that's what's led to Brexit, I reckon.
We're bad winners and we're also terrible losers. Just bad. So, in 2009, British sculptor Anthony Gormley, who's the genius behind The Angel of the North, which if you don't know about it, look it up. Anthony Gormley led a project that he called One and Other, and instead of a sculpture or a statue, for 100 consecutive days, the fourth plinth was occupied 24 hours a day by a member of the public. These people stood on top of the plinth for an hour each, and all had applied in advance. Some people stood in silence, some people sat and just looked around, some bought placards, some dressed up, and some even braved the London weather totally naked.
That was a very, very good idea.
It's a cool project, isn't it? It wasn't even supposed to be about giving people a platform to speak about whatever they wanted to speak about. It was about people being part of the city. Like, it was really, really cool.
But it was Brian Kalipoff who caught the eye of the press more than anyone, because during his hour, he stood next to a cardboard cutout of a woman named Linda Carty and played a message from Linda all the way from her death row prison cell in Texas, accompanied by placard subtitles. And in the speech he played, Linda implores the British public to help her, claiming that they are her only hope for escaping death by lethal injection. And as you heard at the beginning of this episode, she begs the people of Britain to please listen, please tell anyone they know, and to not let her die on death row in Texas. If Carty is executed, she will be the first British woman to be executed in 62 years, and the first British black woman in well over a century. So how is it that a British citizen wound up on death row in 2009?
In the early hours of the 16th of May 2001, Houston Police Department in Texas received a 911 call from Raimundo Rodriguez explaining that his house had been broken into by four African-American men wearing masks. They had ransacked his house and kidnapped his wife, Joanna, and their son, who was only 4 days old. Police arrived on the scene to find Raimundo and his cousin, who lived with him, distraught and having sustained some injuries. Raimundo had actually been, he'd been pistol whipped, he'd been hit in the face. A neighbour of the Rodriguez family came forward, saying that Linda Carty, who lived in the house opposite Raimundo and Joanna with her common-law husband Jose Corona, had told her that she was having a baby the very next day and had patted her stomach. The anonymous tipster neighbour also confirmed that Carty didn't look pregnant at all. Linda Carty and the Rodriguez family didn't know each other, but they did live opposite each other in this neighbourhood. And it's one of those neighbourhoods where all of the houses are exactly the same. The layout is exactly the same. And they're all just like in Edward Scissorhands, the town in Edward Scissorhands, where everything's the same, but like less nice is what this neighbourhood is like. So I do find it quite difficult to believe that although the Rodriguez family and Linda Carty claim not to know each other, I find it really hard to believe that they wouldn't have been able to pick each other out in a lineup because they literally lived opposite each other. So they would recognise each other even if they'd never said hello.
And after this anonymous tipster spoke to the police called Linda Carty and asked to speak with her. Linda admitted that her daughter's car may have been used in the crime, and she directed the police to a nearby empty yard. Here, two cars were discovered, and in the boot of one car was the dead body of Joanna Rodriguez, and she had been suffocated with duct tape and a plastic bag. And in the boot of the other car was her baby, Raimundo Jr. Miraculously, though, he was still alive, despite the Texas summer heat. Now, when the police ran the plates of the car, they found that indeed, just like Linda had said, one was owned by and the other had been rented by Linda Carty's daughter, Jovelle Carty. A lot was made of the fact that there was a baby seat in one of the cars and a bag full of baby clothes. Admittedly, it looked pretty bleak for Linda Carty at this particular moment, and she's picked up by the police and taken in for questioning. And Carty doesn't really help herself here either. She gives the police quite an unconvincing account of how she had lent her daughter's rented car to a man named Oscar, and this Oscar character has never been identified. But Linda does mention someone called Chris Robinson and suggested that he may have also been involved. Linda Carty claimed that she had driven the car her daughter owned to attempt to find Oscar, but had been unsuccessful, which again doesn't really explain why both cars were in the abandoned lot and why she was able to lead the police straight to them.
Yeah, it's such a weird way of explaining it, because what I cannot understand is why both cars were in the same place No one's driven them away. How have they both got there? She can't explain it. No one can explain why.
And also, how did she know they were in that yard? Because it's very weird that the police just come speak to her because of what this anonymous tipster said. And immediately Linda Carty is like, oh, well, with that, my daughter's cars may have been involved in that. All she knows at this point is that she lent her daughter's rented cars to a guy named Oscar. Why would she immediately think that that had anything to do with the neighbours going missing? Like, it's all quite weird.
And you can see the exchange with the police in the 4 hours of interview footage. I can understand why it must have been incredibly frustrating, because they keep asking Linda, like, how is Joanna Rodriguez's body in the boot of your daughter's car? And literally all Linda can say is that she doesn't know, she wasn't there. Javelle Carty, later in an interview, she explains is that she had hired the car because her mum needed to move house, and she didn't want to give her mum the car that she owned because she just bought this car for herself and it was the first one she'd ever bought. She didn't want her mum to like fuck it up by moving stuff in it. Fine. Doesn't explain why the car that she owned was there. And Javelle, I found this so frustrating. Javelle also, in an interview, admitted that she's not really sure what actually happened, which I find totally extraordinary. Like, your mum is on death row and you're doing multiple interviews about her innocence, but you're not actually 100% on what happened the night of the crime. Like, that makes very little sense to me at all. And I feel like that's why this case is so much of it is so muddy, and you're just not really sure what actually happened. And it's because nobody says anything. Like, everyone's just like, oh, I'm not really sure. And you would think that, you know, she's implicated as well. She was a suspect because the cars are in her name. Why doesn't she care? Why doesn't she want to find out why they were there? It's completely bizarre. And we absolutely still don't have a clear answer as to why two of her daughter's cars were in the hands of at least three gang members, with a dead body in the boot of one and a baby in the boot of the other. Much to her detriment, Linda doesn't have the answers either. But my boyfriend, Clive Stafford Smith, does have a theory. He says that, I'm not sure how far I can go along with this, but Clive says innocent people are actually the most difficult to defend because they don't have a story, they don't know, they weren't there. You know, his argument is it's much more difficult to convince a jury of innocence than it is of guilt. And I do think that does hold water to a certain extent.
Yeah, I think anecdotally speaking, that is bound to be true, because if you're not guilty, then you are much more likely to have sort of holes in your story. You wouldn't have an alibi. You might have just been at home on your own. You wouldn't have looked to secure some sort of, you know, cover up or alibi for when a crime was being committed. So I can buy that to some extent, but it's not exactly an airtight defense of Linda Carty. You know, as we'll see as we go, it's not as cut and dry as it seems. So hold on. Because three men, including Christopher Robinson, mentioned by Linda during questioning, were identified as the men who had broken into the Rodriguez home. The others were Carlos Williams and Gerard Anderson. Christopher Robinson's testimony was the real key here, though, as Linda was struggling to string a coherent story together. He tells police again, this is all on tape, that Linda Carty had recruited him, Williams and Anderson, to break into the Rodriguez home. Robinson alleged that Carty told him that there were 900 pounds of weed in the house. Pounds as in weight, pounds. And that there was also a lady in the house who was pregnant by Linda Carty's partner, Jose Corona. According to Robinson, Linda told the gang members that if they brought the pregnant woman to her, that they could keep the weed and any money they found in the house. Apparently, Linda even said that the baby belonged to her because it was her husband's, and that she was going to cut it out of the pregnant Joanna. Another story?
Like, there were four of them. How were they planning to carry out in the middle of the night from someone? No, it's ridiculous.
So they really should not have been that surprised when they broke into the house and they couldn't find 900 pounds of weed. That shouldn't have been a surprise to them.
And Robinson counters this by saying that when he first met Linda, she was a big-time weed dealer, selling pounds of weed at a time. So to him, he said that it didn't seem totally outlandish that she would know where 900 pounds of weed would be.
I feel like 900 pounds of weed is in a warehouse somewhere. It's not in someone's home.
But apparently that was what they were going in there for. But when it came to the trial, the prosecution ran completely with Christopher Robin's version of events, and the trial is honestly just an absolute shit show. Linda Carty was put on trial for capital murder. Capital, because it was in conjunction with kidnapping, and this is how she would end up on death row.
And I really feel like when someone ends up on death row, it can be to do with the severity of the crime, but I feel more times than not, when someone gets death row instead of life imprisonment, it's because they've got a shitty lawyer. Linda Carty had the shittiest lawyer of all time. He had so many former clients on death row in Texas, people called him the State Undertaker. His real name was Jerry Garano, and he's literally one of those, like, Better Call Saul TV lawyers. He has been named and shamed as the worst capital defense lawyer in the US. 21 of his former clients are currently on death row. That is more people than 26 states have on their entire death row. He is genuinely a world record holder for having the most clients on death row. It's completely unbelievable stuff. But the Undertaker of the state of Texas was all Linda Carty could afford. And she really was in trouble before the trial had even started, because Linda was born on St. Kitts on the 5th of October 1958, and St. Kitts did not gain independence from Britain until 1983. Therefore, Linda Carty is a British citizen, and being a British citizen entitles her to help from the British government. She's a citizen being held on trial in a foreign country, and by international law, she is entitled to this. And her lawyer, Gerano, never contacted the British consul in Houston, Texas. He didn't even have to go very far. He was literally in Houston. It's not like he had to go to a different city.
That's unbelievable.
It is totally unbelievable. He didn't even try. And like whether, like this, you'll see that this is just how I feel about this. Whether Linda Carty is innocent or not, this trial was an absolute fucking disaster. As a criminal defense lawyer, having someone who's a foreign national is kind of like an ace in your sleeve, because you can, the foreign government, it's in their interest to send the best lawyers they have to help you. So why you wouldn't do that is completely baffling to me. And the terrible lawyering just, it continues throughout the trial. And it's not helped by the fact that Robinson, Williams and Anderson were originally charged with capital murder and themselves at risk of the death penalty. But they were given a plea deal offering them prison sentences rather than the death penalty if they testified against Linda Carty, which obviously they did. All three of them admitted to their part in the break-in, but equally, they said they had been set up by Linda. She had lied to them about 900 pounds of weed being in the house. When they broke in, they couldn't find it. It wasn't there. Linda had lied. But for some reason, this didn't stop them bringing Linda, Joanna, and her baby son. As we've said, Connie Spence, the lawyer for the prosecution, builds her case around Robinson's testimony in particular. So this is what Spence argues. Jose Corona, who is Linda Carty's common law husband, she lives with him. He really, really, really wants a child. And Linda Carty had recently had a miscarriage. She'd had a miscarriage 5 months before Joanna Rodriguez was murdered. So Connie Spence says that Linda Carty was so desperate to stop Jose leaving her because she couldn't have a baby, that she schemed to steal Joanna Rodriguez's baby, even though it hadn't been born yet. And Spence described Carty as knowing people who were interested in doing things illegally, which is such a weird thing to say. Why wouldn't you just say she had criminal friends or she had a criminal network or something? Like, and also Connie Spence does spend a lot of time talking about how manipulative Linda Carty is, and how she manipulated these three men into breaking into this house for her, which, whether she did or she didn't, they're career criminals, these men. She's not corrupting them, and I feel like Connie Spence does try and put that spin on
it. And I do find that a weird part of this case, that they were career criminals, but the prosecution was so gung-ho on going after Linda Carty. Why offer plea bargains for these gangbangers who had were career criminals, as we said, to put this woman away? What made her so important that they needed to put her on death row? That's a part of this case that I find really bizarre. Anyway, in this version of events that Robinson had been touting and that had been used in court against Carty, Carty enlisted the help of Robinson and his gang, lied to them about almost the ton of marijuana in the Rodriguez house, and made them promise to bring her a pregnant Joanna. What Linda Carty didn't know, though, was that Joanna had already had her baby 4 days previously. And in a later interview, Connie Spence gives an incredibly emotive account of how Joanna was naked and asleep next to her husband and her baby when the masked men broke in, and how the family didn't even understand English, so just how scared they must have been. And yes, absolutely, what happened to the Rodriguez family is absolutely horrifying. We are not taking away or in any way diminishing the tragedy of this murder. But they definitely did speak English. Raimundo, the father, gave news interviews the next day to TV crews in English. And it did seem like a really odd thing to say, but I guess it just ramps up the vulnerability. It increases the public hate towards this woman. The fact of this new mother lying naked next to her family, people breaking into a house, they can't speak English, even though they can. It's just adding to the vulnerability of these people. You don't need to make this situation even more tragic or make these victims even more vulnerable. What happened to them was already awful. But what's weird here is that why does she need to do this? Why does she need to get so emotive about this?
That's what I don't get about Connie Spence, is that if she is so sure of the facts, if she is so sure about Linda Carty's evidence, if her case is enough,
yeah,
just the fact, why is she bothering to give this emotive story? It doesn't quite sit right with me.
It is quite unsettling to hear a lawyer like that reverting to kind of emotive storytelling. It doesn't come across, as you say, as someone who's confident in their own case if you're relying on pulling on emotional heartstrings to be able to make your case. And throughout the case, the prosecution maintained that Linda had suffocated Joanna Rodriguez with duct tape and a plastic bag and left her in the boot of a car. Spence also gave a detailed description of how afraid Joanna must have been, and hammers home again and again the no English thing. And the prosecution's case was built on the idea that Linda Carty was so desperate to keep her partner from leaving her that she was willing to cut out a baby from Joanna Rodriguez. But the fact is, she didn't need to. The baby was already out. Linda had no reason to kill Joanna at all.
Yeah, I just think that's a bit of a flaw in the prosecution, that like, if Linda wants a baby, why wouldn't she wait until the baby's born anyway? That just seems bizarre. But so if she thinks that Joanna is still pregnant, she gets to the house, or Chris Robinson and his crew get to the house, and she's not pregnant anymore, the baby can literally just be picked up and taken away. Jackpot, surely. I don't understand why.
But then saying that, the idea of women who, because women who steal babies, women who steal children, they steal babies or they steal infants, they don't steal sort of older children. And we have seen lots of cases, we haven't covered any yet, of women who have cut unborn babies out of other women. I think maybe there is something to women needing to have that baby from the very first breath and not having it be in the possession of another woman. There is something to that. And it's as horrific as it is, it's not totally unheard of. So I can buy that that could be a thing that she was planning. And maybe these men, you know, playing devil's advocate, they go into this house, they've been told by this woman, you can keep the drugs, you can keep the money, but bring me that woman. That they just think that that's also what they need to do. They'll take the baby and they need to bring the woman because she's telling them that baby was fathered by my partner. Maybe they think that Linda also wants to kill Joanna because of the affair.
Yeah, that's true. That's a good point, actually. Because that, and Connie Spence kind of comes at it from a similar angle of, she argues that Linda's there for the whole thing. So Linda would have had to have killed Joanna because she could have identified her, their neighbours. She knew what she looked like. So maybe there's a bit more weight to that argument. But what I don't understand, again, is, so say that Linda Carty has suffocated Joanna and she's left her in the boot of a car. Why does she leave the baby in the boot of the other car? That's what she wants. That doesn't make sense.
Yeah. Unless she thought the baby was dead, but I don't know. That doesn't make any sense.
If she's so desperate for a baby that she's willing to kill another woman, she's going to check if it's breathing.
If you've been listening to Red Handed for long, you'll know that we're diehard devotees of the best shapewear brand around, Honey Love. They're an independent, female-founded brand with intelligent products designed by women who actually wear them. Looking for bras so comfy you can work, live, and even sleep in them while still feeling supported? Honey Love has got you covered. Literally. For everyday wear, I recommend their best-selling Cloud Embrace bra. It's so lightweight that it feels like, yep, your boobs are being hugged by a cloud. And their shapewear is designed to move with you, so no more rolling it up the second you hit the dance floor. Treat yourself to the most advanced bras and shapewear on the market. Use our exclusive link to save 20% off Honeylove at honeylove.com/redhanded. That's honeylove.com/redhanded. After you check out, they'll ask you where you heard about them. So please support our show and tell them that we sent you. Experience the new standard in comfort and support with Honeylove. Does anyone else feel like August is the Sunday of summer? It's the perfect time to hit reset before the autumn rush. And for me, that always starts with my wardrobe. Quince specializes in effortless, high-quality essentials like ultra-soft organic cotton and premium stretch denim. Everything at Quince is priced 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Because they work directly with ethical factories and cut out the middleman, you're paying for actual quality instead of brand markup. Their leather handbags are gorgeous and honestly just as good quality as designer names. I find myself reaching for Quince accessories as the perfect finishing touch for pretty much all of my outfits. Upgrade your everyday. Go to quince.com/redhanded for free shipping on your order and 365-day returns. Now available in Canada and the UK too. That's quince.com/redhanded for free shipping and 365-day returns. quince.com/redhanded.
Some of us are not naturally money people. And if you're not, it either means ignoring things and letting it all pile up around you, or spending hours staring at a spreadsheet every few weeks trying to make it all make sense. If you're doing the latter, let me give you back your time by telling you about Rocket Money. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that helps you find and cancel unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps you lower your bills so you can grow your savings. Rocket Money tracks your subscriptions and lets you unsubscribe with just a few taps. Plus, it automatically categorizes all of your transactions, helping you to organize it all and revealing your real spending patterns so you can set budgets, goals, and alerts. Let Rocket Money help you reach your financial goals faster. Join at rocketmoney.com/redhanded. That's rocketmoney.com/redhanded. rocketmoney.com/redhanded.
Connie Spence also argued that in Linda's handbag, she had a pair of surgical scissors with which she intended to cut this baby out of Joanna. And if Linda's lawyer had bothered to even look at the scissors, he would have seen that they were bandage scissors. They were small, they've got rounded ends, and there's absolutely no way they could cut a person out of another person. But he didn't look at them. He didn't examine the evidence, so that argument was never brought to court.
More weirdness in this case, though, was that phone records showed that Linda's phone had been used to call Gerald Anderson 11 times in the early hours of the 16th of May 2001. So now we've got this extra added link that these phone calls have come from Linda's phone to this person that was involved in the break-in. But Linda claimed that she had just simply left her phone in the car, so in her daughter's car that had been taken, and therefore it could have been used by Chris Robinson and his associates during their kidnapping of Joanna Rodriguez and her son. It was 2001. I mean, her phone wouldn't have a password or a passcode on it. Anyone could have used them.
Well, I don't know what kind of phone I don't think I had a phone in 2001.
No, I didn't have a phone in 2000. I was 10. I didn't have a phone in 2001. No. But then again, it's just so much of this case is circumstantial because, okay, you've lent this car out to this Oscar guy. It's been involved in this kidnap. It's been involved in this break-in and this kidnapping and this murder. You've also left your phone in there. At no point before that did you say, my phone was missing. It's only when it comes up that it's been used to make calls to these people that are also accusing you of arranging this hit, this abduction, whatever we want to call it. Again, it just seems very... She is either just the most unlucky woman in the world, or she has something to do with this.
Yeah, that's how I feel.
It's like Amanda Knox, right? Exactly what she says in the opening of that documentary. Either I am the most unlucky person ever.
She says I'm a murderer or I'm you. That's what she says.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah, exactly. And this could happen to anybody. So Christopher Robinson testified in court that he had taken Joanna Rodriguez and her son to the abandoned car lot with Linda Carty, and that he and his associates left to go and change the money they had stolen from the house so they could split it evenly between them, and that when they came back, Joanna Rodriguez was dead. I mean, it's a weak story, but then so is Linda's explanation of how the cars got there. This is the problem. Neither one of their stories is particularly compelling. Neither one of their stories is free of flaws. And both of their stories depend really heavily on circumstantial evidence.
Absolutely. And the problem with Christopher Robinson is that in the Werner Herzog documentary, he gives like a proper interview. He's in prison. I think he got like 45 years. And the way he talks about Linda Carty, he's like, she's the wickedest lady I have ever met. I could have saved Joanna Rodriguez. I could have saved that woman. Linda should have been dead instead of her. So if that's true, why did you leave this woman you think is the devil with this lady you've just kidnapped and you were nothing to do with it and you just wanted to save her? That's bullshit.
Whether Linda had anything to do with this or not, obviously the case is so clear for why Robinson and the others all admit to this and just say, you know, plea bargain, we did do this, the police have got enough on us, but plea bargain, we'll point the finger at Linda and we'll just get life imprisonment instead of the death penalty. Ugh. Robinson also stated that after they discovered Joanna was dead, so when they come back from exchanging this money, that he had then driven Carty to a hotel, and that when he dropped her off, he saw that her room was full of baby clothes. That's pretty weird.
It is weird, but I think it's really... The prosecution go on and on and on about this, and I really don't think it deserves as much time in the trial as it got.
I don't know, because she explains it that she had these baby things in her possession because she'd had the miscarriage 5 months before, which would make sense. But she was also in the middle of moving house. So she was moving the last of her things into her new house. Why is she taking all these baby clothes? I don't know, maybe that's not the biggest issue. But I don't think we can discount the fact that it is absolutely, in my mind, an adequate accusation to say that this woman was planning on stealing this baby. I think sometimes when women go through that kind of grief of a loss of a baby or a miscarriage, and there is sort of underlying other problems, as we always talk about, this isn't that rare, kidnapping children, even cutting a baby out of a woman. So I don't know. I don't find it so crazy that I find it unbelievable. I just find so much of this other case doesn't fit together with that.
I don't think that women who have suffered miscarriages and, you know, other things that have happened to Linda that we'll get onto later, you know, it can affect you mentally. And if you're unstable mentally, these things can happen. People do kidnap babies. The thing is with, and I know a lot of the defense is circumstantial, but I can completely understand if Linda had had a miscarriage, but she's so excited, she's bought all of these baby things, it would be so hard to throw those away. So I can understand if you're moving house, you just think, I'll just take them and I'll deal with it later.
That's true. I think that's fair. I think maybe what's not clear here is that if Robinson was so convinced that Linda Carty is this evil woman and the devil and all the things that he describes her as in these interviews, and he says that he wishes he'd killed her and all of this stuff, why did he offer to drive her back to her hotel? Why doesn't he just drop her off outside? Why does he go up to her room? Because he had to go up there to see in her room that there were all these baby clothes. And another piece of evidence that the prosecution used, which makes no sense, is that Linda's fingerprints were found in both cars. Now, of course they were in the cars. They were her daughter's cars. I don't think that doesn't prove anything. But what Connie Spence doesn't tell you is that Linda Carty's fingerprints were not on the duct tape or the plastic bag used to suffocate Joanna Rodriguez. They were just in the car, which there's a perfect explanation for why they would be in there.
So Girano, Linda's lawyer, the worst lawyer in the history of the world, also failed to take the opportunity to visit St. Kitts where Linda was born, even though the state of Texas had offered to pay for his trip. Like, even if you're the worst lawyer in the world, like, someone's just been like, hey, do you want to go to the Caribbean? I'll pay for it. That's such a... Why would you not do that? And had he bothered to go to St. Kitts, he may have been able to create a more convincing defense in court because he would have had more of a connection with Linda. And Clive Stafford Smith says that, you know, how are you supposed to look a juror in the eye and convince them not to sentence someone to death if you have no connection with that person? And I think it's really clear that her lawyer made no effort to make a connection with her. So Linda Carty was born in 1958 on St. Kitts, where she grew up. She worked as a primary school teacher until she got pregnant when she was 20 years old. She got pregnant to a policeman. And this actually caused Linda to lose her job because that's how it was. Like, a baby out of wedlock was the ultimate embarrassment in the Caribbean at the time. So her life was over. Her life on St. Kitts was done. The father of the baby completely distanced himself, and Linda Carty's family shunned her. Javelle Carty, her daughter, was born on St. Kitts in 1979. But to escape all of this, Linda took Javelle and moved to Texas in pursuit of the American dream and a fresh start in 1982. And Carty was keen to build on her academic background and started a pharmacy course at Houston University. One night after class, she was walking through the car park, trying to find her car, when two men attacked her. First, they demanded money from her,
and then they raped her. And after this, Linda became too scared to go back to university, so dropped out of her course. Her daughter Javelle recalls that her mother became depressed at this time, and this was when she rapidly began to gain weight. And the worst bit is, as a result of this rape, Linda fell pregnant. As she was Catholic, termination was totally out of the question. Linda Carty carried the baby to full term and gave it up for adoption. After this, Linda entered into a series of bad relationships. One of her boyfriends beat her, and one of them was a big-time drug dealer. Linda claimed that she didn't know about his illegal activities, which I think it's quite difficult to not know your boyfriend is a drug dealer.
Yeah, and this is the thing. This isn't a totally one-sided case. There are things about Linda Carty's past that just don't show her as an angel that people will want to try portray her as. Because, for example, on the 3rd of March 2001, so just 2 months before Joanna Rodriguez's murder, Linda Carty was charged with car theft. She had hired a car and refused to pay for it because she claimed that she was an FBI agent. It's important to note, though, that this crime was actually committed in October 1992, but it just took all that time to get to trial. And as far as I could tell, Carty was not charged with the impersonation of the federal officer. She was sentenced to 10 years probation on the condition that she became an informant for the DEA. Now, although Linda claimed that she had been recruited by a friend of hers in the Houston Police Department and that they were trying to get her drug-dealing boyfriend, the probation option seems much more likely to be the answer. Now, Linda Carty, who was soon operating undercover, infiltrating drug-dealing gangs in Houston, she assisted on 2 arrests. I've read and heard people saying that 2 arrests isn't that many, and that Linda Carty had vastly exaggerated her time as an informant, that the DEA found her difficult to work with. But she'd only been doing it for 2 months. I reckon 2 arrests in 2 months seems pretty good.
So many people just being like, oh, well, like, she was so difficult to work with, and she says that she helped arrest hundreds of people and blah, 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 blah. She only even did 2, but she was only doing it for 2 months before she was arrested.
She did get them quite a bit of information to get 2 arrests in 2 months. But I can imagine people being difficult when they become informants like this. I mean, after your recommendation, I listened to The Aryan Princess when I was on my trip. And in that, she's an informant. Oh, yeah. And how difficult she is, how much the power kind of goes to their head a little bit, and how much she was, I don't know, I think, listen to it, and I think it gives a really good insight into what can sometimes happen to people who are informants. And so after listening to that, I can kind of believe that maybe she'd become quite difficult to work with. If she was a great DEA agent, you know, informant, sorry, why did they throw her under the bus so easily? Why wouldn't you protect your informant?
If that's what I can't answer.
And that's what I find quite weird, but her boss at the DEA, Charlie Mattis, said that he would have happily appeared as a character witness on her behalf, testifying that he, government agent who knew Linda Carty, thought that there was no way she was capable of this crime and that she was not a violent person. And that Charlie Mattis said that he was shocked that to have not been called upon by Linda Carty's lawyer, Gerano. This is the thing. Okay, so maybe he was willing to not throw her under the bus and go and testify, but Gerano just didn't call him. But what is with Gerano? Yes, he's a shit lawyer and he has so many people on death row and he's just totally unsuccessful at this. But not going to the British embassy, not going to St. Kitts, now not calling Charlie Mattis, her boss at the DEA. What was going on with him? This can't surely just be chalked up to the fact that he was a bad lawyer. Is there more at play here?
Well, possibly, but if there is more at play here, there has to be a part of the puzzle missing, because yeah, why would they give so much of a fuck about Linda Carty?
This is what's so weird, because on one hand you could say it's total negligence, total incompetence on Gerano's part, and that he just made absolutely no attempt to save Linda Carty's life because he's an incompetent lawyer. But it just seems to be so many things, because he also advised Linda against taking the stand, which I'm just not sure how I feel about. She isn't great at explaining herself, yes, but perhaps if she had taken the stand, it would have helped the jury to see her as a human being rather than as a monster.
Because one juror, called Tommy Cubana, called Linda Carty, and this is a direct quote, he said that Linda Carty is the most evil person, pure evil, right behind Saddam Hussein and Osama bin Laden, which literally made my eyes roll out of my head and onto the floor. All the prosecution had to do was just present some emotive testimony and be like, she's a baby killer, she needs to go to death row. And because there was absolutely no resistance from the defence, that's what happened.
How has she not been able to appeal this? Because surely, like, yes, one of the easiest ways to appeal is saying that you were given insufficient, inadequate defence in a capital trial.
Her appeals have been denied.
This is why I don't understand, because the easiest way to get an appeal to be upheld is to say that you were given inadequate defence in a capital trial. Like, this seems crazy.
That's why this is so bonkers, because all of those things have been presented and now she's got reprieve on her side, she's got all of these world-class lawyers working for her, and still, it's not being reopened. In one of the documentaries, the Werner Herzog documentary, at the end of the interview with Connie Spence, the prosecution lawyer, she accuses Herzog of making the documentary in an attempt to humanise Linda Carty, and Herzog is just like, I'm not attempting to humanise her. She is a human being. And that's why I think it's quite dangerous to call people monsters when they do awful things, because it dehumanizes them. And I think that's such an important thing to see everyone as a human. I think it's dangerous. We'll get into dangerous territory when we stop seeing people, no matter what they've done, as people.
And I think that the reason for that isn't just because, oh, before anyone accuses us of being bleeding heart liberals, my reasoning for why we shouldn't refrain from using terminology like monsters when people have done horrific things isn't just to see them as a human being and act kindly towards them regardless of what they've done. It's because when you start to call people monsters or demonic or anything like that, you take away from the fact that we as human beings are perfectly capable of doing evil, depraved things. And it's a very easy way to excuse us and move our behavior when people commit extreme behavior, to say that has nothing to do with humanity, because it absolutely does. It's a fundamental part of humanity. And I think that's why we shouldn't call people monsters, so that we understand that this type of behavior is human. We can't separate ourselves from that. There are people who go around killing people for no reason, but they're mentally ill. Like, I'm talking psychotic.
Well, exactly. That's a mitigating circumstance.
That is a mitigating circumstance. We are against the death penalty, but like I spoke about before, even though I believe in rehabilitation, sometimes the time has to meet the crime, mitigating circumstances or not. Like, if you murder somebody, I'm not against life in prison. Like, I think that is absolutely valid.
No, it's the right to a fair trial, and the fair trial is finding the mitigating circumstances.
Yes, that's the key thing. The right to a fair trial, and if the fair trial finds that you deserve life in prison, then you deserve life in prison. So anyway, we've taken a bit of a digression into the world of criminal justice. So just to recap, Linda Carty's lawyer failed to contact the British consul, which cost Linda Carty access to better lawyers. He didn't bother going to St. Kitts, even though he was offered the money. He didn't call the government agent to testify on Linda Carty's behalf. He didn't contest the fact that the scissors in Linda Carty's bags were surgical. He didn't let Linda take the stand, and he spent less than an hour with her before the trial. I just don't know on what basis he thought he was going to be able to win this case, or whether he even cared if he won this case. But okay, take away the plea deal testimony of the three career criminals. What did the prosecution have? The cars were in Javel Carty's name. Linda Carty led the police to the cars. Linda had some baby clothes and a baby car seat in her possession. Linda allegedly told people that she was pregnant when she wasn't. Is that all enough to kill someone? Or is there enough reasonable doubt? What bigger motive did these three men have for incriminating Linda Carty than to save themselves from the death penalty?
This is it, isn't it? I think, like, the prosecution's case is not enough. Like, I have reasonable doubt. I have a reasonable doubt about this, and that is not...
But that's because you know of all of the things that Girano didn't do.
Yeah, of course.
Looking at it from this point. But what I mean is, if you were sat in that jury room and you watched the prosecution, Connie Spence, come out, give all of this information. Like we said, it's not totally unheard of that these things, that a woman could do these things, because we've seen it in other cases. You see the defense lawyer put up absolutely no fight. Nothing is being picked up on. You have no idea that he didn't go to St. Kitts, he didn't go to the British consul, he didn't do any of these things. I can see why the jury said that she was
guilty.
Oh
no, I completely see that.
This makes no sense from the outside and what people's bigger motivations were. Why did Girano did not build a proper case for Linda Carty? And was there a bigger motive for these three men to incriminate Linda than just to save themselves? Do they need a bigger reason?
No, I don't think so. I mean, it's perfect for them. But what I cannot understand is why the state are going after Linda Carty. Why would they offer a plea deal for 3 to 3 career criminals in order to put a grandmother who was employed by the DEA on death row? That I just cannot get my head about it. I feel like there has to be something missing. Why were they so keen to execute her? It is quite an astonishing failure of the system. And so much so that Paul Lynch, who's the British Consul General to Houston, Texas, said that the system has actually changed as a direct result of Linda Carty's case. So surely that's an admission of guilt. But she's not being pardoned. Her appeals aren't going through. Is it because they want justice for the family? Is it pigheadedness? It just seems bizarre that she hasn't got a retrial. Like, if you're so sure that she's guilty and she deserves to be on death row, retrial and prove it.
That is the weirdest part. Mm-hmm.
But also, do I think that Linda Carty is as manipulative as Connie Spence says? And I think possibly. She does this thing in both of the documentaries that we watched where she sings Amazing Grace directly to the camera with her eyes closed. And it not only is it pretty haunting, it just made me think of that bit in About a Boy where they sing Killing Me Softly and Hugh Grant can't even look because it's so like weird and cringe. Like, I just struggle with people doing closed eyes singing, and especially because it was Amazing Grace. Like, it just didn't quite sit right with me. Like, I think she could be a manipulative person. Is that enough of a reason for her to not get a retrial? Absolutely not. You know, whether she did it or not, like, her level of involvement is, I feel like it's almost impossible to know. But her trial was undeniably an absolute fiasco. And you can find the details of Linda's case on reprieve.org.uk. Appeals in 2004 and 2010 were denied. So clemency from the governor of the state of Texas is her last shot, which for someone on death row to get clemency from a governor is, like, incredibly rare. But I think it's 95% of people on death row do die. Like, once you're on death row, it is incredibly difficult to get off. The governor doesn't have to like Linda Carty. He doesn't even have to think that she's innocent. Just that the state failed to give her a fair trial. And that's what people are campaigning for. I mean, with that, let's say thank you to our Patreon supporters this week. We've got Terry Rea, Holly King, Bridget Walters,
Googlimity.
Complicated surname. Who went from a $5 to a $20. And we've got Christy Dirk Fuller, who did a $2 to a $5. And Chris Calilady. So thank you very much, you guys.
And also some 5-star reviews this week. First one from Oh Gosh Flowers. It says, take notice, this podcast has absolutely everything a true crime fan is looking for. It's well-produced, intelligent, well-researched and empathetic. The hosts seem to be sincere and lovely people. Thank you for your time and the work you put into each episode. Cheers. Oh, thank you. You seem like a sincere and lovely person too. We are only sometimes.
And then next we've got Lucky Jean, who says we're a fabulous feminist true crime podcast and that they love the perspectives and they feel empowered after listening. And that's great. Keep being empowered.
Absolutely.
Go out, change the world.
And then There Might Be Cupcakes, who says, sisters from another mister. As these fine ladies already know, thanks to my clumsy Twitter flirting, I adore them and their podcast. They don't shy away from the grim details, but they balance this with remembering that these people are real people. True crime with heart, wit, and charm. And that is from Carla, who does the There Might Be Cupcakes podcast. And yes, Carla, we've seen you on Twitter. Thank you.
Social media moment of the week. It's quite an important one, actually. If you listen to our Suzanne Kappa revamp episode, we talked briefly about suicide being the number one cause of death for young men in the UK. And I said it was for men under 30. I was actually wrong. It's actually men under 45. And a lovely listener posted in our Facebook group about CALM, who are a charity. It stands for the Campaign Against Living Miserably, and they support young men in mental health. And they do incredible work exploring how we can do more to prevent male suicide.
Have a look at CALM, definitely. And as usual, you guys know we're on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook at Red Handed the Pod. Come join us on there. Please do go leave us some more 5-star reviews on iTunes. It gives us such a boost and it makes us such a big difference for our visibility. So please do that if you get a sec. And also head on over to the Patreon if you've even got a dollar to send over to us a month. That would be great. So thanks, guys. See you next time.
Don't forget, tell your mates. Always tell your mates. See you next time.
Bye.
Bye.
Your vehicle doesn't just get you from here to there. It's a bridge to the people and places that matter most. It's how you show up for your family, your community, and everyone else that depends on you. That's why for 125 years, Firestone has been building tires with one thing in mind: to deliver products that are as reliable as you are. Firestone, always dependable since 1900.
Looking for your next thrifting experience? Check out the new Goodwill Columbus location in Westerville. Our new store is full of the latest secondhand selections with options rotating daily. From warm weather clothes to home decor, you may find your new favorite items just in time for spring. Each purchase helps us create opportunities throughout Central Ohio. It's shopping that looks good, feels good, and does good. Come shop at 60 East Schrock Road or learn more at goodwillcolumbus.org.
Got stubborn spots, unwanted hair, or uneven skin? The CAPS Laser Center offers advanced solutions. They offer a full range of advanced laser treatments like Halo and Moxie that help reveal smoother, clearer, healthier-looking skin. CAPS is one of the top providers in the world for laser treatments, and their expert team delivers personalized care every step of the way. When you book your first Laser Center appointment, you'll get a $50 CAPS MedSpa gift card. So don't wait. Book today at experiencecaps.com. CAPS, where confidence begins.